You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, March 22nd, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Ian Millhiser, editor of Think Progress Justice. Also on the program today, terror attacks rack Belgium. Up to 31 killed, nearly 200 injured, just days after the last perpetrator, or I guess direct perpetrator of the terror attacks in France, was apprehended. Also on the program today, President Obama, major speech today in Cuba, talking about a thaw with Cuba. It's obviously historical to have a U.S. president there. Meanwhile, SCOTUS rejects Colorado's, or I should say, a challenge to Colorado's pot laws. Feds are saying they may not need Apple's help in cracking the iPhone of the San Bernardino terrorists. Gotta wonder what that's about. We're now at $121 billion worth of defaulted student loans in this country. A loan is not in default until it has been over 270 days late. And meanwhile, the ticking time bomb in Iraq, which could literally jeopardize the lives of 1 million people. Donald Trump set to be the least popular major party nominee in over 30 years.
Those polls have been very unfettered.
And 25% of GOP voters think that protesters should be roughed up. You know, just as a matter of course.
I don't understand where Donald Trump comes from.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, he's just so singular. Such a singular phenomena. Quickly, you know, obviously, if you want more details on this, the best place to go is probably to your TV or to Twitter. But the summary is this. At one point last night, U.S. time, that would have been probably early morning time in Brussels, there were multiple explosions that followed one another. There were two explosions at the city's main international airport. One apparently was smaller, the other larger. Initial reports, and again, you know, in situations like these, folks, initial reports are very often incorrect. But the initial reports are that one explosion came from a suitcase. The other one may have been a suicide bomber. There were reports that a Kalashnikov was found in the airport, but there were no reports of gunfire. Then there was an explosion at a subway station. And between those two attacks, I think 14 at the airport, 20 at the subway station, around there. Again, these are initial reports. And then about almost 100 at both locations injured. 15 killed at the airport, 20 at the subway station. This is 4 days after the arrest of Salah Abdeslam. He was the sole survivor who was believed to be directly involved in the attacks that killed 130 people in Paris, France, the second week of November. And apparently, I mean, this is all speculation, but seems a reasonable assessment. Whoever was involved in that cell that was protecting Abdeslam, basically, once he got captured, put into motion a plan that they obviously had already worked on. Now, the thing about Belgium is it is sort of notorious for both having very weak counterterrorism operations. I mean, it's sort of impossible to imagine a guy basically at large in this country for 4 or 5 months, never mind one with the territory of Belgium. There's also a lot of problems with the isolation of the Muslim communities that are in Belgium. And there's also a lot of travel in between Belgium and Iraq. So all of these things, you know, conspire to make it possible for a guy like this basically just to be avoiding capture. A pretty pointed lesson in why you don't want to alienate certain segments of your population that you would rely on. You know, but we've had situations in this country where bombers of abortion clinics were able to be on the run for an extended period of time in the countryside, aided and abetted essentially by, you know, people living in very rural areas. Be much more difficult in this country for an Iraqi citizen or a former Iraqi, or frankly, a Muslim, to escape into the hillsides in Georgia or in Tennessee. But we have problems with, you know, right-wing nationalism in this country in that respect. But when you create environments where you've alienated large swaths of your population, this is one of the byproducts. Unfortunately, in this country, we don't have that problem. We don't. I mean, there are people who are attempting to do that, not the least of which is the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party, and then probably the potential challengers to that presumptive nominee, and all of their advisors on foreign policy, it would seem like. And then, you know, other segments of the so-called liberal intelligentsia.
Thought experiments.
Yeah, I was going to say the, liberals who are, I don't know, teaching meditation and whatnot. I'm not sure. I don't want to.
Don't dis meditation.
I don't want to paint with too broad a brush.
Meditation's
but,
a good
thing. But that is the point there. We'll talk more about this story in the so-called fun half of the program. We're going to talk to Ian Millhiser about Merrick Garland, who he is and what the implications of his pick are. And sort of more broadly speaking, what the implications of replacing a conservative judge with a moderate judge versus a liberal judge, and just broadly speaking. But before we get there, today's sponsor is Casper Mattresses. They're obsessively engineered American-made mattresses at a shockingly fair price. And now you can get $50 off any mattress purchase by going to casper.com/majority using the code majority. Listen, you spend about a third of your life sleeping, with the caveat, of course, unless you have children. Let's make sure you're doing it on a good mattress. Casper brings together two comfy technologies, latex foam, memory foam. So they got the right sink, they got the right bounce. And this is the best part about it, and this is why Matt, our producer, who was just yawning on cue for the first time, has not gotten a good night's sleep, but that's because we had him do an extra work last night. This is why Matt loves it. And I noticed I was on Twitter the other night, and Hayes was like tweeting about Casper Mattress or back and forth with somebody about it. They've got a risk-free trial and return policy. They deliver it straight to you. You can try it for 100 days. If you're not happy, they pick it back up. At the store, what? You get about 60 seconds. It's $500 for a twin-size mattress, $950 for a king-sized mattress. Those prices are right in line with what you'd find in the industry, except for you actually get to see if you like the mattress. So get $50 towards any mattress purchase by going to casper.com/majority using the code majority. Terms and conditions apply. All right, folks, going to take a quick break. Reminder, this program relies on your membership. When you become a member, we say thank you by giving you extra content. We're going to have more bonuses in the future, folks, too. Oh, it's going to be so great. But nevertheless, don't do it for the bonuses. Do it to support a program you listen to on a fairly regular basis where you can get long-form interviews about stuff that you can rarely hear anywhere else. I mean, I don't want to be too definitive, but I mean, tell me where, because I'll go listen to it and I'll poach their guests. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Ian Millhiser. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Ian Millhiser. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund, editor of Think Progress Justice, and author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. Ian, welcome to the program. And I have to say, it's your book is why I wanted to talk to you ultimately about Merrick Garland and about and get your analysis of what kind of choice this is by President Obama. Welcome to the program.
It's good to be back. Thank you so much.
All right. So let's start first, though, with before we sort of analyze this pick. I mean, just give us, who is Merrick Garland?
Sure. So, I mean, you would guess from the title of my book that I'm very cautious about the Supreme Court doing too much. And so from my perspective, I like a lot of what I see about Judge Garland. I mean, Judge Garland is a very restrained judge. He's a judge who has tended to be very loyal to precedent, and when there's play in the precedent or when there's a question that's unclear, he tends to take incremental steps and not try to have these sort of sweeping pronouncements that we've seen so often from the Roberts Court. And for the most part, I think that's a good approach. Now, you know, two things that should be said about him. One is that I wish he was a lot younger, because at age 63, if he is confirmed, he's not going to serve as long as someone who is younger. And then the other is that while I suspect that he's going to vote with the liberal bloc almost all the time, if the court keeps hearing the same kind of cases that it's been hearing, one thing that's going to happen once you have a liberal majority is a lot of the really ambitious conservative lawsuits are going to go away, because everyone's going to know they're going to lose. And you'll start seeing liberals file more and more ambitious suits trying to move the law to the left. And at some point, I think that Garland would probably want to put the brakes on those efforts, you know, probably sooner than maybe a Justice Ginsburg would.
Okay, all right. So I want to circle back to that aspect of it and stay on Garland just a moment. And if it's possible, I don't know if you're on a speakerphone. If there's any way, maybe you could you could get off that, because it's just sounding it's breaking up just a little bit on our end.
Oh shoot, I apologize. I'm in a bit of a cave here. Let me try moving.
Oh, that's great. Okay. And
okay,
yeah, that's a little better. Thank you. And so, all right. So Garland, I mean, just give us some of the more sort of, I guess, straight details. He's coming from the D.C. Circuit. So give us a sense of like, and you say he's a restrained justice. He's not that ideological, is that accurate? He's reserved as far as they go.
I think that's right. I mean, the D.C. Circuit is somewhat of an unusual court in that it hears less of like the hot button issues that sometimes come up in other courts. It hears a lot more agency questions dealing with what the power of federal agencies are and when it's the role of the judiciary to defer to what a federal agency is doing. And Garland has generally voted in favor of deference, which, given where the parties are aligned right now, is something that I suspect that Democrats are going to be happy with, you know, at least in the short to medium term, and Republicans are going to be very unhappy with.
Explain that to people, because, I mean, this, you know, maybe this is just sort of a function of that I don't get out enough, but that part of his record is pretty exciting to me, because
right,
so much of what we talk about in terms of the regulatory state has been, you know, we've seen it undermined by the Supreme Court, and it was a big issue when the D.C. Circuit was not with its full complement of justices. But so tell us how, you know, what the implications are, at least on the D.C. Circuit, for things like Dodd-Frank and EPA,
right,
and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and National Labor Relations Board. I mean, this is where a lot of the sort of like meat and potatoes of governing, where this is where this is the stuff coming out of this court is really important.
Right. So, you know, especially as Congress has become more and more dysfunctional, the president's had to look more and more to powers he already has under existing laws in order to govern. So, you know, one of the biggest and most important examples of this is his Clean Power Plan, which is a very ambitious program to reduce overall emissions, I believe, by 16% in this country. It's a very ambitious target for one regulatory policy. And this is something like Congress didn't have to pass a new law for Obama to do this. He was able to use his existing authority under existing environmental laws to implement this plan. There's a lawsuit currently underway challenging this, just like there's a challenge to his immigration policies, just like there's a challenge to, you know, many other EPA policies, just like there's a challenge to some of his labor policies, where conservatives are trying to say that the degree of deference that courts have generally paid to agency actions, the court should not continue to give that degree of deference. And if the conservatives win on these arguments, what it means is that presidents like Obama are going to lose their ability to use their existing power as a failsafe when Congress falls into the dysfunction that it's fallen into right now. So pretty much, you know, because Obama hasn't been able to sign any major legislation since the Republicans took over Congress, pretty much everything he's done for the last 6 years of this presidency could hinge upon whether or not we have a justice in there that's going to continue the policy of deference, or whether we have a justice that's eager to shut down agency action.
Okay, I guess I can't help but get ahead of myself, but I want to just stay on this for a moment. So let me ask you this. Putting aside whether or not Merrick Garland ever sits on the Supreme Court, let's assume for a moment that he does, okay?
Right.
Part of the way that, say, for example, the financial industry has been fighting Dodd-Frank is by having lawyers show up with regulators from the SEC, let's say, and just be like, you know, we're going to litigate this. You're going to spend right. 2 years writing this law, and then we're going to take it to the D.C. Circuit Court. And if we lose there, we'll take it to the Supreme Court, and you're going to lose because you're not right. going to have the authority. I mean, I don't know if things get this naked, but that's sort of the undercurrent. Does having a 5-4 majority on the Supreme Court with even a guy like Garland, who maybe someone like I who would want something who's a little bit more, someone who's leaning in a little bit more, but having a guy who has a record of deferring to agency actions, does that trickle down? Does that basically embolden regulators? Does it have any implications beyond the fact that if that case ever gets up there, in other words, does it send shockwaves, maybe shockwaves is too big of a word, tremors through the system?
Well, I think it's certainly true. I mean, I have friends who've worked in very high-level legal positions within agencies, and, you know, the term for the high level of deference that's granted a lot of these cases is Chevron deference. Chevron is the name of the case that created this legal doctrine. And they tell me all the time how much they love Chevron because it just makes their job easier. So it's certainly the case that, you know, if agencies feel like there's not like some complex legal doctrine they've got to work their way around, if there's not like a fear that the Supreme Court's going to change, strike them down, you know, if there's one less thing that they need to worry about, you know, of course they're going to be more aggressive because they only have but so much time on their hands. And the time that they spent trying to anticipate how John Roberts is going to change the law 3 years from now is time that they can't spend, you know, doing what they're actually there to do. You know, you bring up Dodd-Frank. I mean, where this regulatory authority really matters the most is with newer laws like Dodd-Frank or the Affordable Care Act, because often when Congress writes a law, it leaves a lot of the particulars to the agency. So, you know, there's a case being argued tomorrow dealing with what is often referred to as the birth control mandate. And where the birth control mandate comes from, there isn't an explicit mention of birth control in the Affordable Care Act. Where it comes from is that Congress delegated to the agencies a task of coming up with a long list of preventative coverages. It includes things like cancer screening. It includes things like childhood vaccinations. It also includes contraceptive care that all health plans should include. And if the agencies don't have the power to do their job there, what happens is Congress just passes a vague statute saying you need to come up with this stuff. If the agencies can't come up with it, then no one ever gets those protections because the regulations they're supposed to fill in the details never get written. So, you know, when we talk about this issue of agency power, we're not just talking about whether, you know, presidents can get creative with their existing authority. We're often talking about whether or not a law really exists at all, because without the regulations filling in the detail, often the bare statute is useless.
That dynamic, I think, is so misunderstood or just the general public, I just feel like, is just not aware of how that dynamic works. And so, I'm always excited when we have just an opportunity to sort of illustrate that dynamic. And Merrick Garland's pick, in some respects, is just one of those opportunities. All right, but let's talk about the pick in terms of, and then I want to circle back again to that Zubik case, which you just referenced in terms of the birth control, because that's a big deal. And I know you're heading over to the Supreme Court tomorrow to watch the yep. The oral arguments. But so from a political perspective, I mean, Merrick Garland, he's 63 years old. He is a white guy. From Harvard, which is, you know, going to be sort of fascinating to see what that's like to have a white guy from Harvard.
Imagine having a sixth justice from Harvard.
What's behind this pick? In other words, does President Obama think this judge is going to be seated at any given time? Does he feel that this was the best opportunity to seat a judge? Was it just, this is a judge that, this is a like a classic Obama pick? Was this an attempt to leverage the politics of the Republicans obstructing not just the nomination, but the process for the nomination? What's involved here? What are the different calculations that you understand went into this pick?
So I think there's several things in play. I mean, one is I think that Garland genuinely is the kind of judge that Barack Obama wants on the Supreme Court. You know, Obama has spent the last 7 years of his life basically being harassed by lawsuits brought by conservative activists relying on, you know, more and more creative legal theories. And I think that Obama probably thinks that a little more judicial restraint would be a very good thing right now. But setting that aside, you know, I think that there's two related things going on. You know, one is that Obama is offering the Republicans a pretty good deal here. You know, a 63-year-old who's not going to serve as long, who's widely viewed as a centrist, you know, come September, if the polls show Hillary Clinton up 20 points over Donald Trump, some Republicans in the Senate might think that they're better off taking the offer that's on the table than holding out and potentially having President Clinton nominate someone who's 49 years old and more liberal. So that's in play. You know, and then the other thing is, you know, Obama's go-to move, you know, sometimes for good and sometimes for less good, when he finds himself in a political box, is he makes a show of being the most reasonable guy in the room. And Merrick Garland is among the most distinguished judges in the country. He's, you know, very widely respected. He's, you know, viewed as largely non-ideological. And, you know, if we had a better system where, you know, you just picked the best judges and not like the best judges who will cancel out the ideologues that were put on by the other party. You know, if we had a system where we were just trying to pick the 9 best judges in the country, I think Merrick Garland is probably one of them. And so I think that this is Obama being the most reasonable person in the room and saying, look, like, you wanted me to pick someone here. I've picked someone that no one can argue with.
All right. Fair enough. But we don't live in that world. And right. I mean, you know, that's like saying if everybody in the at my dinner party had manners, then I could put out the nice china. But if one of them is a monkey and I put out the nice china, it is irrational for me to expect that this nice china is not going to get broken, right? I mean,
right.
It's nice that Merrick Garland would be a great pick in a vacuum, but we don't live in a vacuum.
Right.
And we've had a series of, I think, fairly radical decisions, and correct me if you disagree with that. I don't think you do, but by this conservative court, and to sort of, I guess, move off those, we may need someone
right.
who is a little more aggressive. That's even putting aside the sort of like the political implications, because all this assumes that the Republicans are even capable of making the deal that you're talking about. I mean, even if
right.
they see Hillary Clinton there, they may be thinking like, okay, A, there is no, I mean, what we're learning from this election season is that, A, there may not be a Republican that could make a rational decision. You know what I mean? Like a Republican entity or institution that could say, okay, guys, you know, here it is. Let's be rational now in the way that we do this, because there's no one to say that, right? I mean, because they may not have even done this in the first place. That's
it's a very good point. I mean, I've made a similar point, which is that the problem, and you know, Citizens United is a huge part of this. You've got so many different islands of influence mm-hmm. within the Republican coalition, mm-hmm. and so many of them have enough money to put up a credible primary challenger if they want to, that, like, let's say it's September and Hillary Clinton's 20 points up and Mitch McConnell realizes, like, oh, this is about to be a disaster for us. You know, the strategic thing for us as Republicans is to confirm Merrick Garland. If McConnell makes that decision, and if it's the right decision for Republicans, I don't know that there's anyone in the GOP who has the power to give Mitch McConnell permission to do that.
Right.
And that is a problem, you know, that they have to deal with. You know, it's not like Mitch McConnell can call up Grover Norquist and say, hey, Grover, I need you to keep all these interest groups off of my back and off of my senator's back if they vote yes. You know, I don't know that anyone has the power to keep those primary challenges from happening. And so in that sense, you know, that's why I ultimately think that a confirmation here is unlikely.
Even in the lame duck, because it's the same dynamic, right?
Right. I think that's right. I mean, I think that realistically, as obnoxious as the GOP's talking point that the next justice should be picked by the next president is, like, I think that's probably a fair description of what's going to happen, because, you know, when you've got 54 senators, that, you know, 54 is more than 46.
Right. And so let me ask you this too. I mean, it seems to me that if I'm a Republican, I'm thinking, like, look, there's a decent chance that there's going to be another pick that Hillary Clinton has. And so, you know, if we back this up, she may have to push that second pick into, you know, 2018 after we have maybe taken back the Senate, if they think they're going to lose it in 2016. I mean, I guess what I'm asking is, like, was this a rational pick by President Obama, or did he just say, screw it, I'm just going to pick the kind of guy I like, and, you know, politics and frankly, reality be damned. I mean, because on some level, that's a fairly irresponsible thing to do, it seems to me. And let me ask you this. It also seems to me that, you know, that Obama, this is sort of like a legacy pick for Obama. If I'm not going to get anybody confirmed, I want historians 6 or 7 years or 10 years from now or 20 years from now to look back and say, and he picked the most palatable guy. A 63-year-old white guy. I mean, that's the profile of every senator he's looking to confirm them, and probably every Republican voter, right? I mean, the average Republican voter is probably a 63-year-old white guy. Maybe he's 53. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, so I think it's a rational choice. I mean, if that's the test. I mean, if I had my druthers, you know, if there were someone who has very similar views to Merrick Garland, but is also a 49-year-old woman of color, I would have picked that person instead.
Isn't Sri Srinivasan sort of that guy? I mean, he's obviously not a woman, but Srinivasan.
Right. Yeah, I mean, Sri is another D.C. Circuit judge, a much younger D.C. Circuit judge with a more moderate profile. You know, I think that, like I said, Obama's play here is he wanted to make a big show of how reasonable he's being and a big show of how unreasonable the other side is being. And I don't know that the outcome would be any different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the folks who aren't going to confirm the 63-year-old white guy certainly aren't going to confirm the 49-year-old either. And so I don't know that, you know, between those two, the outcome would have been much different.
Does it have a different calculation in terms of the election? In other words,
it could have a different.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it could have a different calculation. Now, I mean, I don't know how much the Supreme Court plays out in the, you know, how much people care about those granular questions.
Right.
About you know, well, if you pick this guy instead of this guy. And, you know, one thing that Obama does get for nominating Garland is, you know, the media coverage of Garland has been fawning. And I think rightfully so, because Garland's an impressive guy. And, you know, would he have gotten the same coverage if he had picked a different nominee? I don't know. So, you know, the answer here is, you know, if I had a magic wand and I could use that magic wand and pick any one person and put them on the Supreme Court, it wouldn't be the guy who's 63 years old. But I think that Merrick Garland's an outstanding judge. And I think that, you know, he's a perfectly reasonable choice given the constraints that Obama faced.
All right. Well, we'll look into like a Kickstarter maybe to get you that magic wand. I'm not sure. I'm not sure. We have to look into see how we could get that. But all right. So moving forward, I want to talk about Zubik, but I just want to stay on. Do we have a sense of like the kind of justice that Hillary Clinton will pick? Or let me start with even a broader question. The idea of getting a more liberal justice. I mean, I remember maybe it was 10 years ago listening to Pamela Carlin, who is a law professor at Stanford, and I think now is in the U.S. Deputy Assistant Attorney General for Voting Rights. I think she's still there.
She recently left.
Okay. Well, she was making the argument. I know that she was also maybe not a short list, maybe an extended short list in 2009. But she had made the argument, and this is 10 years ago, and this may have, obviously it's going to change with Scalia at the very least, but she had basically said, it's been decades since we have replaced a justice with a justice who is more to the left than the justice they replaced. And I don't know if that's changed since then. Maybe it has, arguably, Souter or whatnot. But what are the implications of doing that? I mean, obviously for Garland, you said it's going to stem the tide, but it's not going to necessarily send those tremors down to the legal community on the left saying, hey, this is your opportunity to create to expand rights or to get a more active judiciary or give it wider latitude for government agencies.
Right. So I think the question comes down to what you want out of the court. I mean, if you want someone who is going to reverse a lot of the damage that we've seen from the Roberts Court, then I think that, you know, a person that Hillary Clinton would pick is likely to be that person. You know, they may not necessarily write the word Citizens United is overruled, but there's lots of ways to undo the damage of Citizens United without having to write those words. You know, they might not necessarily write the word Shelby County, the terrible voting rights decision, is overruled, but there's lots of ways to reinvigorate the Voting Rights Act that, you know, don't require overruling a precedent. So, like, I think it's very likely that, you know, we're going to have a five-justice majority soon if Hillary Clinton is elected, who will undo many of the more aggressive precedents of the Roberts Court. The question is, once that task is done, how far will the justice be willing to push from there? And, you know, you can look at historic lawsuits. I mean, I think, you know, one of the first things we want to do after we're done clearing the low-hanging fruit is we want to get rid of partisan gerrymandering. There's probably four votes right now on the Supreme Court who'd be willing to rethink some bad partisan gerrymandering precedents. And, you know, it may matter if someone's a liberal or a moderate, if they're willing to join those four. after that happens, you know, then you get into some hard questions. You know, back in the 70s, there was a lawsuit claiming that poor school districts had to be given the same kind of resources as wealthy school districts. And it's a difficult question. I mean, first of all, like, it's a difficult question how you ground that sort of lawsuit in the Constitution's text. There are difficult questions about how you enforce the suit if the plaintiffs win. Several states have said that there is some sort of requirement that poor districts receive similar funding to rich students, and those victories have been hard to enforce.
Hmm.
So I think that someone like a Merrick Garland might be less willing to go there than the most liberal. Justices that, you know, could potentially be in the mix. And that's really, really where the spectrum is. I mean, I think that anyone is going to staunch the bleeding. I think virtually anyone picked by a Democrat is going to roll back, the decisions that, you know, we can just rattle off that have been the more damaging decisions of the Roberts era. And then the question from there is, you know, once you're done undoing damage and you want to actually start affirmatively taking steps to the left, how far is the new justice willing to go? I don't know that there are four votes on the court right now who are willing to take some of the more aggressive approaches, and I don't know that everyone that a President Clinton would appoint would agree to do so either.
Right, and we don't really know, right? I mean, we only have a sort of a like parameters of where a guy like Garland could be. I mean, he has not a great record, it seems to me, from what I've read about criminal defense, but he hasn't necessarily been in a place or a position where we would get a full sense of that, right? Because, I mean, if you're on a circuit court, your job is to follow precedent. There's no, if you are of a judicial temperament, I guess, or the kind that, you know, the sort of a reserved judicial temperament, your number one job is to conform with the law rather than to even sort of entertain the idea that the law could be incorrect or incorrectly interpreted at this point.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I mean, I think that that's true even at the Supreme Court level, is that, you know, in any given case, I mean, the Supreme Court isn't strictly bound by precedents. They have the power to overrule precedents. But in any given case, I think the way that most judges, I mean, they're judges who don't think this way. I think that makes them very bad judges. But most judges, the way that they approach it is that in a difficult case, there's a range of outcomes that the precedent will permit. And a more liberal judge will pick an outcome that's at the leftward range, and a more conservative judge will pick a case that's at the rightward side of that range. But, like, there are certain outcomes that just are, you know, would be too radical given the universe of law that we have right now and that no reasonable judge would pick. What happens, though, when you have a conservative court, as we have for 40 years, is that range moves to the right over time because the precedents move to the right over time. And so we don't know yet, because we haven't had a liberal court for a very long time, what the law starts to look like when that range starts moving to the left. And, you know, maybe Merrick Garland would be willing to do something 15 years from now that, you know, he wouldn't be able to do right now, because there's a slow process when you're a judge of, like, taking each case, assessing what the range of outcomes is, picking the outcome that you think is proper, and then when the next case comes up, all of a sudden the boundaries have shifted.
Right. You're slowly chipping away at these foundations, or at least constructing a sort of an alternate foundation that can sort of support the weight of these cases as, you know, and when you ultimately take that other foundation away, I guess. Let me just ask you one more sort of practical question that just occurs to me. I'm not 100% sure I understand this. But in terms of Chief Justice, the Chief Justice always serves as Chief Justice until they vacate the seat, or does that change if the balance of the court votes for a new Chief Justice?
No. At the federal level, once you're appointed chief, you remain chief for life. Okay. You know, there are states that do it differently, where, like, the court will pick, will elect one of their own members in some states. In other states, I think it's just whoever the most senior member of the court is automatically becomes the chief. But at least in the United States Supreme Court, the practice has always been that someone is appointed Chief Justice. And, you know, if 20 years from now, Roberts is the last remaining Republican on the court, he's still going to be the Chief Justice of the United States. He'll probably just write in dissent a lot. It'd
be sort of a drag, I would imagine, a little bit. Now, all right, so just quickly, tell us about this Zubik case that you're going to be sitting in tomorrow.
Sure. So this is, I mean, really a bigger birth control case than Hobby Lobby, because Hobby Lobby made a lot of changes that matter a lot to law professors. They made a lot of doctrinal changes. And, like, the most scary thing about Hobby Lobby is it opened up the possibility that someone could raise a religious objection and use that objection to take away the legal rights of someone else. Zubik, though, deals with, you know, Hobby Lobby said, like, yes, this is theoretically possible, but we're not sure that it matters in this case, because in this case, there's this alternative method the government that could use that'll still make sure that women get access to birth control. So just try that alternative and we'll deal with that later. Zubik involves that alternative. It's the way that things work now, if you work for a religious employer and your boss objects to birth control, is that the company's supposed to fill out a form saying we object, and then most of the time the insurance company will work with you to get you a contraception-only plan. So everyone's supposed to still get birth control, that, or at least almost everyone that would have got it under the original plan will get it under this plan as well.
And the idea is that the employer is sort of, you know, at arm's length and once removed from that process. It's sort of like a Shabbos goy a little bit. If you will, sort of, I can't use the lights, so I've had the neighbor come by and turn on the lights for me.
I mean, it's somewhat like that, but I mean, you know, bear in mind that what all the precedents have set up to this point, well, they've said two things. Like, one is that they said that a religious objector doesn't get to dictate what a third party does. So they don't get to dictate what the government does. They don't get to dictate what the insurance company does. And the other thing that all the precedents prior to Hobby Lobby said is you can't use your religious objection to take something away from someone else. So if the government wins in Zubik, what it means is that Hobby Lobby might wind up being something that we remember as something we got really scared about, and then it turned out not to be that big of a deal because, you know, it may be the case that religious objectors only get the ability to stop you from doing something, getting something one way, so long as you can get it some other way.
It becomes a constraining principle, essentially.
Yeah, you know, it becomes something that basically creates an additional administrative burden for the government.
Right.
But so long as everyone gets their birth control, and so long as some of the other claims that you've seen, like no one gets to discriminate against gay people, you know, there's actually one case out in Utah where someone claimed a religious objection to cooperating with a child labor investigation. So, like, so long as, like, practically everyone remains in the same place, you know, if the government has to do a little bit more paperwork, I think that's a problem we can live with. What we're going to find out is whether that's the problem we have to live with, or whether the problem is that, you know, people actually start getting their rights cut off.
Right. And so this is a big deal. So what happens when it's 4-4? I mean, because if I had to guess, you know, it's either going to go against Zubik or it's going to be 4-4. I mean, so does this go back down to the appellate court that it came from? What was the ruling in the appellate court?
Well, first of all, I'll just say that, like, I think there's a pretty decent chance that the liberals peel off Kennedy here. Kennedy sort of signaled in Hobby Lobby that he was comfortable with the fill out the form option that's now on the table. So we'll see if he still feels that way, but he's at least signaled in the past that he's probably okay with the fill out the form option. Now, I mean, if it is 5-4, the ordinary rule is that the lower court's order stands. And what that means is that if you're a woman who wants access to birth control, your rights are going to depend upon where you live. And often you know, where a lawsuit is brought that deals with your rights. Most lower courts have said that this fill out the form option is fine.
Mm.
The exceptions, there's actually only one exception, it's the
Texas?
Eighth Circuit, which is, I'm actually the very, very conservative judge down in Texas said that the fill out the form option is fine. That's another reason why I'm optimistic. But the one court that has sort of departed from the consensus is the Eighth Circuit, which is Minnesota and Nebraska and Iowa and Arkansas, and there might be one other state in there. And so what that means is that if you're a woman and you're in Texas, you have one set of rights, and then you can cross the border into Arkansas and suddenly have less rights if there's a 4-4 decision.
Wow. Well, I mean, that's, there you have it, right? I mean, we'll just have a series of, it'd be interesting. I mean, we're experiencing that with things like voting rights, aren't we, right now? And a couple other issues, I think, because of this, the refusal of the Republicans to seat another judge.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that could come up. I mean, you could have abortion rights be one thing in Texas, and then you have more abortion rights if you live in, say Pennsylvania. You know, you could have this come up over and over again. The voting rights context, the situation you have is actually even worse than that. The situation you have is that you have many years of precedents which are very hostile to voting rights, and those precedents remain good law until there's a fifth vote to get rid of them.
Right.
And so often it depends on what your state legislature looks like and whether your state legislature is going to enact terrible laws. That said, like, there is some room to tweak those precedents around the margins, and in the more liberal area, or at least in the areas that have more liberal U.S. courts of appeals overseeing them, you might see that people there wind up with more voting rights than people elsewhere.
Ian Millhiser, author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks, going to take a quick break, head into, I know we went long, but you know, everybody knew that was coming, right? Sam talking to someone about the Supreme Court. That was such a, if you couldn't bet that was going to happen. In fact, I'd be shocked if you bet that we would even finish by, frankly, I want to go another 5 or 6 minutes. I want to ask him about whether or not Vigara would implicate that case from the 70s about whether or not schools in low-income areas deserve the same amount of funding, right? I mean, because Vigara, now that was a California case, but that case was ruled that the rules for hiring and firing teachers were unfairly punishing low-income students because it was hard to fire bad teachers generally, and there were more bad teachers in these low-income areas, or they were suffering more. I mean, the case was not, the implication being that, like, oh, and as soon as we get rid of these bad teachers, there's a whole ocean of good teachers, and I'm using quotes for all of these, of good teachers that are going to rush in to work in these underfunded school districts. But I mean, if you're making that argument about teachers, which is it's really two major resources, right, for a school, teachers and the money to hire them. And so if you could make that argument about teachers, I certainly don't know why you couldn't make that money about money. Maybe we got to get to talk to somebody about that. I wonder why that isn't being made in California. All right, folks. Just a reminder, this show exists because of our members. JoinTheMajorityReport.com. JoinTheMajorityReport.com. Also, JustCoffee.coop, Fair Trade, coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Oh, and today is Tuesday. Another two dope boys dropped. Is that right? You can go to
Matt, go for it. I want to hear the Matt the match spiel.
Subscribe number 2db.com. Subscribe the number 2db.com. If you haven't subscribed, you're missing out. You're missing out big time. I just learned about that guy, Kendrick. What's his name?
Kendrick Lamar.
I know. Michael's laughing, but I honestly had no idea who that dude was.
Oh, really?
None.
I think you'd actually, I could see you getting into him possibly.
That other guy, that guy you had from the posse or whatever they get from the
Rob
your,
Fields,
your crew,
from the crew,
Rob Fields.
The posse, brilliant
guy. I felt like I learned a lot about music that I had no idea about. Now, I have to say, I'm probably on the low end of the knowledge base on stuff like that.
You're a low information hip hop fan?
Yeah, I'm a low information, just about anything outside of what I talk about on any given day.
You're going to start listening to Soca now?
Who?
Soca. Oh, that was the previous episode before before Kendrick. We talked about Soca. That's on the Whole Foods brand F up.
Oh, I'm goes, you know, for some reason my stream, I'm now listening to the Whole Foods thing.
Right. Okay. It goes Whole Foods, then the GE, climate change.
That oranges
formula.
Thing that you guys were talking about reminded me of Matt's problem with cereal.
I know. I think I made some obnoxious crack about that.
Got partially edited out.
Yeah.
All right. So Matt. Wait. So Matt, tell us about this week's episode.
Well, this week we've got an Alaska Airlines made a mistake by naming a campaign Our Eskimo, and it upset some people. And then we talk about Oscar diversity. And do you remember what the third topic was?
The third topic was the growth of virtual reality sports, which
is
multi-billion dollar industry of people actually watching other people play fantasy games. And the emergent of kind of virtual reality industries.
Isn't Twitchy that?
Yeah, Twitch TV.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've contemplated that's what we should be doing here. All right. So if you have not subscribed already, also remember that when you subscribe at subscribe2db.com, you're helping out this program as well, because this is one of our majority.fm family of shows, and it's going to the revenue that, I mean, hopefully this thing becomes a big hit. It's going to the revenue generator is going to help support this show. We have 74 reviews so far. 74 reviews or stars?
74 reviews.
Actual written reviews.
Actual written reviews, 128 stars.
Man, everybody's getting into that. So go over there and give it a review too, because that helps push it up the charts, folks. And if you're on Stitcher, if you listen on Stitcher to this program or to Two Dope Boys, by all means, give it a review there too. That helps. I don't know if they have their own separate review thing. I think they do, or give it a start.
I'm going to look into Stitcher this week, actually.
All right. All right. And don't forget, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com and jet.com. Now we have a link for jet.com. You get 15% off your first purchase. Go to majorityreportkickback.com and justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. All right. See you in the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number.